We are at the Plaza Hotel right after the FAA New York show, which is the Fashion Footwear Association of New York's show. And with me today, I have Alicia
Walters,
who has a degree from FIT and loves the shoe industry.
Uncommon Core presents Shoe Biz with Conrad Bradford and Alicia Walters. I'm Tom Howell. Uncommon Core presents our bonus episodes from the Uncommon Core podcast.
Alicia, maybe you can give us a little insight into what you see happening in the area of fashion, especially fashion footwear for women.
I've been noticing basically the past year, there's been a trend back towards like the 90s and style, like the kind of the showy style of like the late 90s with bright colors and big like silhouettes. So I've been noticing that more designers have been going back to that time and to that style. And I kind of see that they're kind of trying to show like, you know, the very individualized style that everybody wants to present.
Now, you kind of lost me when you said big silhouettes. I have no clue what that translates to mean. Can you give me some examples?
So to put it simpler, it's kind of like, you know, those big chunky heels that we used to wear.
Okay.
So, yeah, I'm noticing that, like, people are trying to return to that a little bit. You know, okay. It's a little less, but I feel like they're still taking the, because now we have sustainability with the designs nowadays, so we're trying to use less materials. So I feel like they're doing it now, but they've put a modern twist on it, so it's a little less heavy, but still has the same like large, like larger than life look that it used to have, if that makes sense.
It looks like those shoes might be a little bit more sturdy, a little bit more comfortable, but they look like they're using a lot more material because they are bigger shoes in general.
That's the thing. I've been noticing that even though they have the same look of the previous designs, like of the 90s, I feel like they're using lighter materials. Like I feel like, for example, Donald J. Pliner, he's been using like a composite material that resembles glass, but it's not quite as heavy. So when you're wearing the shoe, you don't feel like the same burden that you used to feel, because I had those big shoes in the 90s and they were heavy to walk in.
Now, I noticed that a lot of the designers are trying to add a lot of glitter to their footwear. There's a lot of metallics coming in, simulating metal.
Yeah.
Is this just a trend, or do you really see that this is something that's going to have any sustainability?
I've been noticing that too, actually, but I've noticed it more with not just shoes, but with like apparel also. Like there've been a lot of graphics and a lot of like, because I mean, we had graphic tees basically, you know, year round, but I feel like they've been doing more like metallic embossed fabrics and trying to, you know, like incorporate some more like fancier styles. But I kind of feel like it's here to, I mean, I feel like metallics kind of go in and out, and I almost feel like they just change, you know, change kind of like the form, but I feel like they're always kind of there in the background, so.
Now, what I find ironic is that we all talk about sustainability, yet still, the millennials, who are a very large demographic in this industry, in any industry for that matter, they will buy a pair of shoes, and they will wear the shoe down to where it is way past a resole, and they will dispose of it. A lot of the shoes, in my opinion, are built around the idea of disposability. Am I picking something up here?
I tend to agree. I've purchased shoes, and not cheap shoes either, like well-made from, you know, reputable designers. And I've noticed that, like, for example, like the shoes that my mom or my grandmother would wear, like of the same material, just don't hold up the same nowadays. I feel like it's a way to, I mean, it's almost, you know, it's connected to capitalism, of course, but I also feel like it's a way to have people returning, you know, they want them to buy the same shoe again, they want them to buy a similar shoe, but they want them to buy, like, they want them to keep returning, but not because of the durability, but because of the design. So if you have the design that wears away after a certain amount of time, you're gonna go back, they're hoping. But I feel like now they're trying to do longer lasting. I feel like we're trying to make it so that even if it degrades, you know, the materials are going to, like, you know what I mean? Because I'm like, now we're having trouble with things like not being able to be even, like, in nature we have things in the ocean, you know, that just never degrade. So I feel like now we're trying to make it so that the one item that we have will last. So I feel like we're trying to go back to where my grandmother or my mom's day it was.
Hmm. Interesting. You know, I grew up at a time when shoes were made of leather.
Yeah, totally.
And they were made exclusively of leather. And there was something to be said about that.
Yeah.
Nowadays, any shoe, or I say 90% or maybe 95% of the market, mm-hmm. is working with some kind of synthetic material.
Yeah.
But it goes beyond that. The efforts that the industry is making to conceal mm-hmm. the fact that they're not using leather, because they are not educating their sales staff. The sales staff do not know what they're selling. And some of these manufacturers are smart enough to know that they will put a leather sole on a shoe, mm-hmm. but then they'll turn around and make the uppers yes. all synthetic. So they get the opportunity to put made of leather or genuine leather, mm-hmm. but it doesn't represent 90% of the product.
Right.
Do you think that there, and yet still the pricing of these products are in line with leather more so than it is with a synthetic that is, you know, as durable, but not the real thing. How do you see the consumer seeing this? Do you think the consumer is aware of this? Do you think the consumer is interested in knowing or not?
I think it depends on the consumer because, for example, certain brands have created the reputation that they only use certain materials. Like, for example, Ralph Lauren is known for his use of leather and, you know, like harder, more durable materials. But I feel like some of the newer designers are known for style. So I feel like depending on the consumer, if their main concern is the style or the design, then they're more forgiving of certain, you know, design elements such as the actual materials, which is unfortunate. However, I feel like now, you know, there's a merging of, you know, style and function where the materials can be, you know, of actual quality, but actually the actual design is not compromised. So I feel like that's the biggest challenge, you know, as a consumer, because you want the fashionable look, you want, you know, the newest trend, but you also want something that's made to last. You want something that, you know, is going to last you more than one night at the club. So yeah, I feel like it depends on the consumer. I feel like the younger generation might not appreciate, you know, the actual materials that will last, but hopefully, you know, as they age, I think they'll, you know, appreciate it more.
Hmm. Well, I've been in several stores and they will be showing me a shoe or possibly even a leather bag or portfolio, and it will look amazing. Mm-hmm. The color, the texture, sometimes it has a very nice grain to it. Mm-hmm. But then when you take a closer look, you realize you're dealing with a synthetic product, but the manufacturer has gone to a great deal of trouble to line the item or to double-side it so that you don't actually see the reverse side of the leather, so that you don't see the suede, which should be there.
Right.
And the sales staff, I've found on more than one occasion, they are totally duped. They do not know what they're selling.
Mm-hmm.
And based on the price points, you wouldn't think it is anything but a genuine piece of leather.
Mm-hmm.
But as we know, leather and the process to bring it to market is a very, very poisonous way of dealing with the environment.
Right.
That's why I think leather has been kind of taken out of the equation. Many places in New Jersey that were known for tanning and curing of leathers and dyeing of leathers has now, you know, gone offshore.
Right.
Do you think that you would pay more for a leather item rather than you would for something made of vinyl?
I mean, vinyl, the thing is, it depends. I mean, there's other materials, like, for example, leather, of course, is one of the most widely used. But vinyl, for example, can also be lasting if it's well made. But I know that there are some designers that are taking different directions in terms of, like, vegan leather and, like, other materials. But in terms of price, I honestly, for me personally, I care about the quality of the product. Because, like, you know, having designed shoes myself, you know, when I see the stitching or when I see the quality of the actual lining of the materials, then I know that this is a well-made product. So if they take certain liberties with the materials, using vinyl or using, like, you know, like different polymers, then I don't mind as long as the product is well-made. So in terms of leather, I feel like there's some flexibility.
Now, you touched on a term, vegan leather. Mm-hmm. What are we talking about?
So they're trying to, because, for example, the people that practice a vegan diet also sometimes will practice vegan clothes. Like, they will refuse to wear animal-based clothing. So, like, no leather, no anything made from animal products. So now they're starting to do products that are made of natural sources. So they, for example, they found a way to basically process pineapple skin. Like, they've used literal, like, actual pineapple, like, the outside of the skin. And they found a way to make that into a composite leather material. So they're getting a little more creative with, you know, the process so that people don't feel as, you know, as guilty or responsible for taking something away from the environment, but still using something natural. So I feel like more designers are starting to incorporate that for their consumers.
So we're talking about fake leather.
Basically, yeah. But they're at the same time something that's not going to degrade as fast because, for example, the PUs that most companies use is a leather substitute, but it's of the most unacceptable quality. It's just, I've worked with them myself, and they're made for example, when I worked in children's shoes, and since, you know, children outgrow shoes fast, so they're not going to use a leather material for a lower level market price. So it makes sense, but at the same time, we have adult shoes with that same exact material, and those are not made to last either. So they're trying to find a way to get the durability of leather, but with a natural product, like a natural non-animal related product.
You're listening to the Uncommon Core podcast.
Now, this is a difficult question, I'm sure. I'm sure there are many difficult questions.
Totally.
But this one, I think, is one that requires an insight into where the industry is heading.
Okay.
There's a lot of consolidation happening, as you know. And that consolidation,
yes.
I think, works. It always works for the corporate suits, but... Mm-hmm. How do you think it's going to play out for the consumer? Are we getting better quality options? Are we getting any type of price fixing? What do you think is happening in the market? Some of the shoes that are being made, sneakers being one of those categories,
mm-hmm.
it's all made by a machine.
Right.
It doesn't touch a human hand,
right.
Which means that there is a machine charge. And, I mean, what do you think a sneaker really costs?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, coming from, you know, having a little bit of background knowledge, it's interesting to see the production process that leads to it ending up on the shelves because I've bought, you know, the materials and I know how much it costs. And the markup is impressive, to say the least. But the main thing that you're paying for is the trust in the designer. Like, you're trusting that the designer has put their best work, that they've used the best factories, that they've used the best of everything to create this product for you. And that's where the consolidation kind of creates a problem because when somebody's been bought by another fashion conglomerate, you kind of start to wonder, like, am I going to get the same, can I trust this designer? Am I going to get the exact same product? Because now they don't even have the same authority that they used to. So I feel like it comes down to looking into the conditions that they were bought under. Because if they're bought by another reputable company, for example, Kate Spade was bought by Coach, and Coach is another company that has been reputable, but lately they've been outsourcing to China. So I kind of feel like you have to look into it from the perspective of who's buying the product and kind of do a little research, you know, to see where your product is coming from.
Now, this is a perfect time to segue into licensing.
Oh,
because
yeah.
Everybody and their mother is doing something in the shoe category.
Yeah.
Now, what does that really translate to mean in the real world of licensing?
It kind of depends because, for example, like, if you have the rights to the brand, then it means that you represent the brand aesthetic. But the thing is with licensing, it means that like anything falls under that. Like, for example, Kenneth Cole has some subsidiary companies that like have no name connected to him, but he sells them, you know, in addition to his own Kenneth Cole brand. So I feel like you have to, same thing, it's like you have to know where the actual like motivation of the original designer, but it's a little difficult because you don't know where their true passion, like for example, Kenneth Cole has done accessories for years, so you know his passion is accessories, but for other brands where that's just a side project, you know, it's, you just kind of have to see and like look into where they got the inspiration to do, to start in that market and hope that they're inspired by the right things.
Because licensing is a great way for a brand to expand. I mean, they go into sunglasses, they go into handbags, they go into shoes, they go into swimwear. But at the end of the day, is it the designer really still in charge of the design, or are we looking at situations where it's all falling into one design studio? I mean, a Kate Spade design studio is thinking only of Kate Spade.
Right.
But if you're now part of a bigger conglomerate, now we're looking at how you might impact on other brands that are under the same umbrella. How does that factor into this?
That's the one thing, because I feel like it's important to understand the brand aesthetic. Like, that's where it's the designers, like whoever is hired under that designer has to understand the brand aesthetic, because as you work under a company, you learn that their look isn't their look, and you have to figure out how to not make it cross over. Like, Steve Madden has a whole different aesthetic than Kate Spade. Even though some of their pieces might be similar, you have to find a way to make sure you streamline it so that the customer knows this is a Kate Spade product, this is a Steve Madden product, and there isn't any blurring of the lines, which comes down to, like I said, the designer knowing the brand and the brand, you know, making sure that they reinforce what they expect.
That's a good example, Kate Spade and Steve Madden, because they are related on the corporate leadership.
Right.
However, every time I look at a Steve Madden shoe, I know one thing about it. I know that there's going to be a certain level of crudity. It's not as refined. They are definitely looking for ways to actually cut corners and simulate something. So I think it's really interesting.
Yeah, it comes down to the market, because, you know, the demographic that's shopping at Steve Madden is a younger crowd, I feel like. I feel like they're looking for something that's, you know, stylish, but almost temporary. Something that they can, you know, go back to every now and then, whereas Kate Spade is something that you go to for a lasting product, and it's something that you want to represent you long-term. So I feel like that's where the difference comes in with the, you know, quality of materials and quality of craftsmanship, especially.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think also his price point suggests that he's got something for the young, trendy, and he'll take them on a trend that when it drops, it's dropped.
Yeah, that was a good starting point. I remember when I first started shopping, you know, feeling like a grown up. I was like, I'm gonna go to Steve Madden. You know, it's a good starting point to getting something that feels high fashion but also feels accessible, because, you know, you're starting out, you don't really know what your style is, but you know that you want to do something a little more, you know, like high end ish. And I feel like he's a good starting point for that.
One of the shoes that has always intrigued me is Geox. They seem to have come into the market with a specific gimmick, I might call it. And that has been something that they have been able to maintain. They've been able to maintain that. They haven't shifted gears yet, but they have expanded into clothing. Do you think that's a natural fit for a shoe company to go into clothing?
Yeah, it's a little, I mean, I feel like it usually goes in the reverse from what I've noticed. I feel like usually apparel usually comes before footwear, definitely. But I feel like for them, because they've established themselves, you know, kind of as a go-to brand for a certain group of people, that if you can build that same, you know, relationship with your customer into clothing, then I can understand that transition. It might seem, I mean, it is not the normal progression, but at the same time, once you've built that kind of, you know, trust, then I feel like it's a reasonable move.
Now, for me, I like quality shoes, and I'm prepared to pay the freight for those quality shoes. However, when it comes to comfort, you know, I see women's feet in sandals, and they look like they've gone through some kind of battleground.
Oh my goodness, 'cause we have.
I'm just not sure what happens to those feet as they get older, because it must be increasingly more painful to maintain walking around in some of these shoes. Is there any interest on the part of the designer, the high-end designer, to bring comfort into the equation?
Well, I feel like one of the other show designers, we had Donald J. Pliner at the show, and his work actually speaks to that, because I've noticed that he actually creates a way to have a stylish shoe that also maintains comfort. Because one of the things, especially in New York, you can be stylish, but you have to walk. And especially when you have to go between meetings, you have people to see, you have places to go, you have to change from a daytime outfit to an evening outfit, you know. So you have to have that flexibility. So I feel like it's a good way to, you know, move. He creates that perfect way that you can be working all day and still be comfortable and still stylish.
Now, what can you tell me about Sorel? Sorel is a shoe store, a company that's been around a long time. Are you aware of that?
Actually, I am. I just recently became one of their customers. I've noticed, like, they're another one too, because, like, a lot of times, you know, especially with winter brands, they want to maintain, you know, they want to maintain, like, durability in different weather conditions and a level of comfort. But I've noticed, like, their level of comfort is a higher standard than what I've noticed in other brands, because, you know, they a lot of times will put in extra padding, put in extra, like, lining at the expense of arch support and other things. And I've noticed that Sorel is one brand that has not wavered in that regard, meaning, like, I can stand in those shoes all day and still be comfortable in the weather. So I feel like they found a good middle ground. I really like them.
Well, Sorel is a company that I know personally because I owned a pair of their shoes back in the 1970s.
Mm.
Yeah. And they were always built around the idea that they were for the outdoors.
Yes.
You know, this is not a shoe to be taken lightly.
Right.
And they weren't light either.
Yeah, no, seriously.
But I know that they have upgraded their look for a more urban feel and look.
Right.
And I think that they must have changed ownership or something, because after so many years, it's, I would say, over the last maybe 3 to 5 years, they've actually made a real entry into the marketplace that they didn't do for such a long time before. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, I feel like they've updated some of their styles, because I feel like certain brands, once you've been established, it's easy to just stay within the within the styles you're known for. But I feel like they've branched out a little bit. They've added a few elements of, like, the lifestyle shoe look to their collection. So it almost resembles, like, a casual shoe, not just a winter shoe. So I feel like they've kind of found a way to merge themselves a little bit with the current trends, which is probably why, you know, they've gotten a little more visible.
Now, for a brand like Copperfit, talking about the vegan organic marketplace, are you familiar with that brand?
I just actually started looking into them recently. Yeah, I was just hearing about them. Yeah, I feel like they're part of the new sustainable market that we were talking about earlier, and just, like, trying to actually create, like, guilt-free clothing and materials.
Now, every time I hear organic, anytime I hear vegan, I always assume they're going to try and get the consumer to pay more. Are they doing that?
If anything, I feel like it's a comparable price, usually. Like, for example, whatever you would pay for a leather good, they're trying to make it so that the quality of the vegan good is at the same level, ideally. So I feel like, if anything, they're trying to match the price point of existing brands with, like, certain, you know, more widespread materials.
Now, this is a name that I'm sure resonates with you, Brian Atwood.
Oh, yes. I'm familiar.
Now, in his case, he's added a celebrity twist to his brand. He's got Katy Perry playing some kind of a role here.
Yeah, I can see that.
How do you see the celebrity factoring into a marketing campaign?
Honestly, it depends on, like, in his case, obviously it depends on the celebrity, but, like, yeah, because I honestly can totally see that working because, for example, like his designs appeal to, like, you know, he has more, you know, like demure designs, but usually it's like for a younger, like hipper looking, you know, client, but also it's like something more whimsical and like out of the box, which, you know, Katy Perry totally represents. Yeah, I feel like it can be a good tie-in, especially if the celebrity represents what your brand shows. So in that case, I feel like he made a good choice because, yeah, she definitely represents that whimsical, out-of-the-box brand that he does, that he has going.
Well, you know, the Kardashians have done a good job building their brands across many different items. Yet still, we don't always see them wearing their own merchandise. Mm-hmm. So are we to assume that Katy Perry has any input in any of this that's happening?
Well, I feel like she might have choices in terms of the design that she chooses to wear and chooses to do.
Really? Okay. Is there anything that the consumer might be interested to know about the industries? Are there any dirty secrets about these shoes that we should know about?
I will say that there's nothing that isn't public record. For example, materials, you know, production processes. I feel like that's pretty transparent. That's the one thing. Like, we care about the making of the product. We care about, you know, the actual production process. So if you care enough to know, then the information is there.
Thank you very much for being a part of this podcast, Alicia.
Thank you so much.
And I'm going to close down the interview by saying this is Conrad Bradford with the Uncommon Core podcast.
Be sure to follow the Uncommon Core podcast on Instagram and on Pinterest. Our Pinterest is Uncommon Core Pod. That's Uncommon Core POD. Our YouTube channel is uncommoncorevideo.com. Merchandise is available at hugthepug.com. Be a patron at www.patreon.com/UCC podcast. That's patreon.com/UCC podcast. For advertising, go to advertisecast.com/1306. That's advertisecast.com/1306. If you missed any of that, you can find it on our webpage at www.uncommoncorepodcast.com or www.uccpodcast.com.
You've been listening to the Uncommon Core podcast. I'm Satoko Smith. Thank you for listening.
Oh, yes.